Greetings, this is Reverend Juliet Nightingale, and welcome to this transmission of Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source, a program centered on near-death, out-of-body, and similar spiritually transformative experiences and related topics, including what people should know about the dying process, the many facets of after-death communications, living interdimensionally and being multisensory, intuition and telepathy, and more. We feature special guests who are both experiencers and researchers, and we also welcome you to ask questions, to call in and make comments. The toll-free telephone number, please make a note of this, is 877-876-5227, and we do welcome you to call in and ask questions or make comments once again. Our special guest this evening is Dr. Pam Kircher, who is both an experiencer and in the ear, and a physician who's done a tremendous amount of work relating to hospice and other work. Welcome, Pam. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you.
Well, it's really wonderful to have you with us. And what I would like to do is invite you to tell us a little bit about your near-death experience, or have you actually had more than one NDE?
I've had only one near-death experience that I had when I was a six-year-old child. It was profoundly moving to me and has certainly influenced all of my life. It occurred back in 1950 in St. Joseph, Missouri, where I was living at the time. And it came about from a tonsillitis that developed an abscess and then developed meningitis from that. What I remember about the experience was having, of course, the terrible pain of meningitis, the headache and the dizziness. Then suddenly I was out of my body in the corner of the room looking with a different vantage point. I'm feeling absolutely no pain. I was completely conscious, completely aware of myself as a soul, who was neither a boy nor a girl, a child nor an adult, but simply the essence of who I am. It was completely peaceful. It was not the least bit frightening. And I felt as though I was surrounded by God. When I looked down and saw the child in the bed, at first I had compassion for her pain, and then I realized it had to be me. And as soon as I realized that it had to be me, I was back in my body. So it was what you would call a short near-death experience, but it was profoundly transforming for me as well.
And even regardless of how long or short the NDE is, they always impact us for the rest of our lives, no matter what.
Absolutely.
That is really, really special. And what also makes me very excited to have you on our show is that you are a physician. And I have been really anxious to talk to, of course, I enjoy speaking to my fellow NDEs, but also to speak to a physician. And how you have integrated this into your work as a physician, and so I'd like for you to tell us about that, because I know it must be very interesting, number one, the fact that you are a female physician, and number two, the fact that you're a near-death experiencer, and all the dynamics that are involved with dealing with the medical industry. How long have you been a medical doctor, Pam?
I graduated in 79, so almost 30 years, 27 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess when you ask me that question, the first thing that comes to my mind is that I didn't really start talking about my near-death experience until long after I had gone to medical school. And so I was always consciously aware of the near-death experience, but I was not always so consciously aware of how profoundly it influenced.
I certainly understand that, because I think that's true for perhaps the majority of us. to, you know, even myself as an adult and child in the ear, it was only really at the millennium or 1999 that I actually started talking about my NDEs also, even though I had them in the 70s and, you know, from the 40s and 50s and 60s on up. And but still, I'm wondering if maybe that did it affect or influence your decision to become a physician, and then how you maybe integrated it into your practice, even though you may not have spoken about it outwardly to others. Surely it must have had some kind of impact or influence.
Well, as I've looked back on it, I will say that I was the first person in my family to ever become a doctor.
Ooh.
So it isn't a family tradition by any means. And from my childhood, I remember wanting to become a doctor, largely because I just wanted to be helpful to people. What I found in medical school, and really even as a physician, is that it's a positive and negative about having a near-death experience, and that is that I'm extremely sensitive to other people and to their pain. And so it makes being a doctor really fairly difficult. It also makes you a good doctor because you're aware of all those things, but you're
Absolutely.
Also very aware of all those things. So it has both the positive and the more difficult aspects to it. And
I
it was
think with
it
all
was,
healing modalities or because I'm also a practitioner of sorts, although I deal more with the mind-spirit aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the body too, because I'm a Reiki practitioner, but like yourself, I'm just so acutely aware of what others are going through, and I can feel them
mm-hmm.
from the marrow of my being.
Exactly.
And so it can be a blessing and a curse simultaneously.
Yes. Yes. And so actually it's become easier when I began as a family practice doctor. I would say that medical school was particularly difficult because of that. And and then also, as you alluded to, when I went to medical school, half the students were not women. They were about 20%. And so there was that element as well. But what has really helped is over the years, as I have allowed my own practice then to evolve into what fits me. And so medical school, you don't evolve, nothing evolves into what fits you. You do what the program is, of course.
Yes.
and the same is true of residency, and I did that in family practice. But when I got out of residency, I went into a family practice where we did a lot of counseling. And that fit more with the spiritual aspects of who I was as a result of my near-death experience. So that was more comfortable for me than medical school and residency. And then after doing that for about 8 years, that was when I really began to understand the profound significance of the near-death experience in my own life and to begin to talk about it. This was back in, I guess 1989, when I began first talking about it, either privately or publicly, but I began doing both at the same time. And from that, I moved into the hospice work. And I believe that people with a near-death experience are ideally suited for hospice work because we're really not afraid of death.
Yes, exactly.
And we really do get those other dimensions that people are experiencing in their last stages of life.
Oh, and that's so important. And in fact, I've been spending a lot of time myself trying to educate people and guide them and help them to understand what is actually going on with the dying person. And I know I do mention this a lot, but I think it's something that everyone will appreciate, both medical and non-medical, just everyone, an article I wrote called The Dying Process from an Experiences Perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually describe what it is, what it feels like, and all of the processes involved with dying.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that as people like yourself and I can convey this information to the people who are also observing a dying person, they won't, you know, be so quick to say, oh, they've lost it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that sort of thing. How do you deal with people who are, you know, making such claims? Do you hear a lot of those kinds of comments when you're doing your work with the hospice?
Well, I actually didn't hear a lot of those comments, and it was probably partly just because of the setting, because I was the doctor who was the chief doctor in the inpatient unit, and we in our inpatient unit, everybody knew that I talked about near death experiences in the community. When I took the job, they knew it, and so when people were having near-death experiences or visitations with deceased relatives, that was not something that was questioned as abnormal, but was actually used as part of our interdisciplinary team meetings to know that these people were beginning their transition toward death, and to know that they were going to be having different issues they'd want to be talking about with the social worker than they had before they were having those experiences. So we really use those experiences to be helpful to people.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And I think part of it is that because I was the doctor, you know,
yes.
It was okay.
Yes.
And in fact, one of the ironic parts was that those kinds of experiences are so common in people who are close to death, that people who were not having those experiences were asking me why they weren't. Which, of course, as far as I know, there's no knowing why someone has them and someone doesn't, or when someone is going to or not. But it became that people were wondering what was wrong with them if they didn't have their near-death experience or see a deceased relative.
That's really exciting to hear, because and it makes sense to me, because I'm sure I too would be wondering, why am I not having this
mm-hmm.
experience
mm-hmm.
that I always have? And even when I am not ill, although I've been on more deathbeds than I can count, including in 89, I'd always have deathbed visions popping out of my body, and, you know, just really knowing how normal it is to
mm-hmm.
go through these
mm-hmm.
experiences. So, that's why I feel very excited about someone like you, Pam, who, as a physician, can let people know, oh, this is totally natural, it
mm-hmm.
is real, these people haven't lost it, they're not hallucinating, they're just toggling between dimensions.
Yes.
And now, what hospice are you working at? And I don't recall what state you're in, because you've moved around a bit. Am I correct? You were here on the East Coast, I believe, and then you relocated somewhere else a few years ago?
I was in Houston.
Oh, in Houston.
And then I relocated to Durango, Colorado. So I've been here for about 12 years now in Durango.
Okay.
And I wanted to go back for just a minute, because it's a heartening thing to hear, and that is that in 91 or 92, I put in the proposal, and it was accepted, to speak about near-death experiences at the National Hospice Organization, which
wow.
is a conference that meets once a year. And at that conference, I spoke. It was a breakout session, so people could choose where they wanted to go.
Okay.
But I had about 100 folks in there, and I gave them a brief questionnaire to complete. And of the 100 people, all of whom were affiliated with hospice in some way, or they wouldn't have been at the conference, of those 100 people, about 95% of them had either talked personally to someone with a near-death experience or had a colleague tell them about somebody with a near-death experience. So I think people are hearing more about it than they feel they have permission to talk about.
Yes.
Because there was a lot of excitement in that room about people wanting to tell the stories of what they had observed or heard. And I got the sense that they didn't always feel free to do that in their own hospice setting.
Well, I've found that true here in Nashville, Tennessee also. Mm-hmm. And a friend who actually was a volunteer there. And she took me over there and introduced me to the volunteer coordinator there. And she was so excited to meet me and to learn more about the near-death experience and about the deathbed visions and that sort of thing. And yet they've, you know, after all these months, they've never called me. So it's like, oh, well, we can get all excited whilst we're in the closet, but we can't do it out loud or in public.
Mm-hmm.
So here where I am, anyway, I've got a lot of work ahead of me to still really bring the word out to the hospices here in Nashville. And maybe you can give pointers to people like myself and others about how we can reach people, because it is so imperative that, of course, the caregivers and the friends and loved ones of the dying individual become more educated and aware of the near-death experience, of the deathbed visions, of the communications that are happening interdimensionally and so on, because it is becoming more and more mainstream, which I'm so grateful for.
Mm-hmm.
Because one time I pointed out, actually I think it's in the article, The Dying Process, where I make a statement: for every near-death experience that has proclaimed, I am an NDE, there's also another one who hasn't come forward yet.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be so nice to be able to provide a way for people to comfortably come out and own the fact that they've had a near-death experience and know someone who has, and not have to feel awkward or ashamed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm really excited that you've made such an impact and that you had this tremendous response during the conference. Now, you said these happen once a year. Are they in different parts of the U.S., or do they also happen on a global basis?
The National Hospice Organization is now called Hospice and Palliative Care Organization. Meets nationally once a year, but I'm sure there are global ones as well.
Is there a website for that?
Let's see. It's NHP, National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization, NHPCO.org.
NHPCO.org.
Uh-huh, because that stands for National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization.
Oh,
so
wonderful.
That's how you could find out when and where the annual conference is?
Yes. That would be really wonderful to find out, because I know that I would like to become more involved as I am able mm-hmm. to, although I have to do most of my work long distance right now.
Mm-hmm.
But some hospices are very open, and the one that you're working for is obviously very blessed because they've got you as their physician. Are you the primary physician there?
Well, this was back in Houston.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and,
okay.
And actually here in Durango, I'm not doing hospice work. I decided when I came here that I wanted to work on bringing integrative care into the hospital setting. So here, what I am is the medical director of integrative care at the hospital, and we have brought energy work into the inpatient setting. which is to me another aspect of amplifying the results of my near-death experience. And it's been enormously useful, and patients have loved it, and it's become a very standard practice in the hospital here.
Now, so I've served to things like Reiki, for example.
We use healing therapy, which is similar to Reiki, and also similar to healing touch that a lot of nurses use.
Yes,
our healing therapy happens to have been developed by the vice president of theology of Catholic Health Initiative, Dr. Carl Middleton. We are a Catholic Health Initiative hospital, so we use that particular energy work in our hospital in conjunction with aromatherapy, music therapy, affirmations, guided imagery, and prayer.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I have loved it.
Oh, my goodness, it has been wonderful.
Yes, I've really loved it. And we are a small 75-bed hospital, a rural hospital here. And in the 4 years that we've had our program, which we call Touch, Love, and Compassion, the TLC program.
Oh, wonderful.
In the 4 years we've had it, we have done over 3,000 sessions. So it is a huge program in this hospital. Probably half the people who go through have a TLC session with those complementary therapies that I talked about. And we have recently brought in our Steps to Surgical Success program, which uses a TLC session for people who are going to be having surgery. We also use Belarus Navrastek's guided imagery for surgery. And then people go home and prepare for their own surgery. And what we're finding is that there's considerably less anxiety during surgery and less pain medicine used after surgery for those people who use this program. So that's the other piece that we're doing here at Mercy. So I've been very involved in that in the last few years, just seeing what could happen. So many times, the general idea in medicine is that you can do things like that, do complementary therapies, in university hospital settings, but not in a rural community hospital. And I wanted to show that you can do it in a small place and do it well. So that has been the main focus of my activity in medicine in the past few years, is making that a reality and taking it into the normalcy, so that now we have 95% of our doctors have said it's just fine to use it whenever you want, whenever the nurse says the patient needs it or the patient requests it.
Oh, I can't tell you how excited I am to hear this news. It is really, really wonderful. And it's so important, too, because as when I was talking to Ken Prather, and I was also talking to Christina Turin, she plays harp and mm-hmm. does harp therapy, and, of course, Ken Prather does hospice work, as you well know, and when I've been so ill, the one thing that I've really cried out for is music. Mm-hmm. And how it really has got a powerful way of turning things around.
Oh, it does.
It is just so incredibly powerful. And then my being a Reiki practitioner, and I've actually got literature that talks about how Reiki is being implemented in hospitals all over the world,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
because what it does is that it will help reduce the damaging, traumatic, or side effects of surgery and drugs,
mm-hmm.
and then it also helps expedite the healing process. So
right.
Again, I think all of this energy work is very much related. It's all about being a conduit and tapping into that universal life force,
mm-hmm.
and transmuting it for healing people. And I just really feel that it's so important that the medical establishment implements more of the complementary forms of medicine and healing rather than just focusing on, as one herbalist called it, break in an entry, and that's how she describes surgery, which I thought was really good. They try to avoid break in an entry and also the pharmaceuticals. So, you know, with the wonderful understanding that you've got about all of this and being able to integrate it into your practice, I so commend you. I think this is tremendously wonderful. And you also give talks about this as well. Am I correct in that?
I do.
Okay. Do you also write?
I have not yet written articles on the healing therapy that I'm talking about. I've given some talks on that. I did write a book on the hospice and near-death experiences back in 94 when I finished the Houston work. It's called Love is the Link. And it's about my life as a hospice doctor in those years.
Is there a way for people to get hold of that, including myself?
Okay. it's actually on Amazon.com.
Okay.
You can get it that way. And it's been published by the Paul Brunton, Brunton, Publishing.
Oh, and that's what's written on your bio, and there's a toll-free number there.
Yes. Do you have that in front of you?
Let me look, because I did just have it. Hold on a moment, and I will open up and see if I can find it. Again, it's called Love is the Link, the name of your book?
Yes.
Okay. Let's see, right here. Okay, yes, through the Lawson Publications. That phone number is 1-800-828-2197. And then the email address for that is Largson, L-A-R-G-S-O-N, is that how?
No, L-A-R-S-O-N.
Okay, well, there's a mistake written in the email then. It's Larson. Let me remove that G then. Larson at lightlink, lightlink.com. And that's wonderful, because I would really love to see that book too and kind of share it all over Nashville, Tennessee, and even at my places back in the UK. That would be really good to know about, because again, it's very important that people know about this information. With the the integration of the near-death experience into hospice work, now, did you just do the hospice work in Houston, Texas, or did you travel to different hospices and give talks and what have you?
I've given talks on near-death experiences to individual hospices, but more to state hospice organizations.
Okay.
So I've done several. I'm trying to remember exactly where. I remember Indiana and New York State and North Carolina. So just various states. Hospice organizations, their annual conference. And just this last year, I was invited to speak about hospice and near-death experiences, and I gave two separate talks at the Indiana State Medical School in Terre Haute, Indiana. So that was a wonderful opportunity to talk about new... I was taking a beep here. To talk about the new the new video that's out, The Day I Died, that the IANS organization has.
Yes.
Have you talked about that before here on your...
I've spoken with one person who was in that video, I believe, or DVD. Reverend Gordon Allen. I've not seen the video, so I'm not really familiar with it, but I know it was released in the UK. And INDS.org is also where our listeners can look up information about that video. So you were actually giving a talk that included information from that? Pamela, are you there? Okay, we seem to have lost her. I hope we can recover her. We were just really into something very special there. For our listeners who would like to find out more about the video, The Day I Died, you can go to www.iands.org, and on the top of the page, they've moved it now, so we're actually having more of a focus of the upcoming conference coming up this fall, this October, 25th and 28th October. The International Association for Near-Death Studies is having a conference, and there is information. It's 30 years of near-death experience research, integrating the past, anticipating the future. And Dr. Pam Kircher will be there. There's going to be a lot of focus on what the medical community has done and how it has progressed over the years in integrating more awareness in the healing process. And here it is, the now available, the most compelling, up-to-date video on NDEs. And it is called The Day I Died. And it was done in the UK, and I'm trying to find some more information about it right now. The video, which is being sold by Films for the Humanities and Sciences, films.com/ID/11685, comes with the right for unlimited public showing, schools, universities, houses of worship, hospitals, hospices, community agencies, and all other public venues, but not broadcast rights over the television. And this is a really tremendous video that has got a lot of information about the near-death experience. And also, if people do join IANS, then they can get a discount price, and the discount price is actually $90. So for some reason, it is very expensive to have this video. But you can also call the International Association for Near-Death Studies to find out more about it, and their phone number is 860-882-1211. And you can also email office@iands.org. Well, I'm really, really sorry that we have lost Pam, and we're not even halfway through the program this evening. So one thing, I guess what I could do is sort of go on to share a little bit about what I've written in the article that I wrote called The Dying Process from an Experiences Perspective. And it is a very powerful article about what one actually goes through when one is dying. And a lot of people do not, you know, really understand that. They're still afraid of dying. They think, in fact, I just had somebody tell me that they believe that once the body dies, that's the end of the story, and nothing could be further from the truth. So what I'm going to do now is share a little bit from this article that might help to sort of calm people's fears down about dying. And it goes like this, and actually this was inspired by my going to the Alive Hospice here in Nashville, Tennessee. Recently, I read a pamphlet that is passed out to staff workers at a hospice facility on the dying experience. The pamphlet was written by a nurse strictly from the perspective of an observer and one who's in the healthcare profession. This is fine because people in the healthcare industry do need guidelines for dealing with end-of-life procedures. However, that can only be hypothetical at best in many areas, simply because the author has not actually been there, lying on a deathbed and dealing first-hand with the process of dying. at least this particular author gave no indication that she'd ever had a deathbed vision herself, or had been on a deathbed, or had had a near-death experience, or NDE. I, on the other hand, have been on multiple deathbeds and have actually died a few times, having flatlined and lost all vital signs. Therefore, I can clearly share with you what one goes through as one dies, and all the dynamics involved with the dying process. This information will no doubt be radically different from what you are comfortable with, and even forces you to stretch your mind a bit, because it has got nothing to do with what one has learned in medical or nursing school. The information is about the reality of death, and it's something that is sure to be very uplifting, taking you out of the darkness in every aspect of the dying process. Hopefully, too, this will help change people's attitudes about the individual who is dying and what he or she is going through. Apart from the physical pain and other symptoms that are present when one is dying, there are a lot of other things going on. Dealing with a terminal disease or other life-threatening illness involves the gentle ebbing away of human life as we know it on the earth plane. When I had colon cancer, I went through lots of pain, vomiting, convulsions, and the like, and all this had me very focused on having to deal with the onslaught and the struggle with my body. However, after a while, my body became more quiet, and I started becoming more and more
detached. Hi, this is Pam Kircher again.
Not because...
Hi. Hello?
But when one is truly dying process, something takes place that's very different from the effects of drugs, etc. And what I am saying here is very crucial because, as we are in the process of dying, we literally go through
a shift. Somebody on with you?
A change of vantage point, a change of...
Hello, this is Pam Kircher.
A change of feelings, a change of frequency, and an upsurge of energy. Are you there?
Hello?
Hello.
Hi. The phone died, and now I've got another phone. We'll see how we do.
Oh, I'm so pleased you are back. Okay, well, I was just reading a little bit from my article, The Dying Process, hoping that some miracle would happen and we would get you back, so yes.
Well, there you go, and I've already read your article, so go ahead.
Well, if you have got, and if you'd like to add anything to that or make comments, boy, I'd really welcome that because... I would really like to work with people in the medical profession to help get the word out. So, thank you for coming back. But, yes, you were talking about the video the day I died when we got cut off.
Yes.
And what were you saying about that now that we can resume?
Well, what I wanted to say about it was I took it with me when I went and spoke to the medical students at Indiana State.
Okay.
And they were very taken with the story of Pam Reynolds, who had the brain aneurysm and was completely monitored during her near-death experience. She saw parts of the surgery that were happening when she had no blood in her brain because they were clipping the aneurysm. And this is something medical students can understand as being completely inexplicable based on what we understand in science today.
Yes.
So they were really taken with that because it was something that was in their own understanding of how things work. There was no way that that could have been happening, and yet it did happen because she described in great detail the surgery that she had no way of seeing or hearing. Her eyes were taped shut at the time, which is what's done during surgery so that the person doesn't get a corneal abrasion. She had plugs in her ears so that they could be monitoring her EEG. They knew her EEG was flat for her brainwave because that's what they needed to do for the surgery. And she had those kinds of experiences that we would normally think would require the senses in order to experience them. The fact that she had those was completely surprising to those medical students and made them really think about all of the aspects. Because so many of the aspects of a near-death experience are a person's subjective telling of the tale.
Yes, exactly.
And that was not like that. And it made every... When that was suspect, when they began to say, wow, I don't understand how she could do that, then they began to open their minds and hearts to all these other aspects. And that's what I found so powerful about it.
Oh, that is really tremendous. Now, you're reminding me of... there was an article written... it was published 19 November 2003 in the Daily Mail about one Amanda Cable. What she was dealing with was a tubular pregnancy, but they also had to perform the same procedure as what you're describing. And of course, I don't remember what the tubular pregnancy is called in medical terms, but they had to completely drain her brain and body of all blood.
Hmm.
So she was completely flatlined. No heart rate, no EEG, nothing. And it was her daughter, her four-year-old daughter's first day in school. When she had her near-death experience, she was able to describe exactly what her daughter was wearing, even though she had no idea. She was also able to describe what the doctors were doing. And after the procedure, her husband came in bearing a photograph of her daughter's first day of school, because it's very typical in England, the first day of school, to take pictures of the students.
Sure.
And she had on the exact same clothing and colors that her mom had seen and described during her near-death experience.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I've got the copy right here in my files of that article, and it's a big, huge, you know, two-page... And it's not in a tabloid either, and I really love sharing this article because this is just proof in the pudding, as it were, that there's no way this woman could have had a hallucination. Furthermore, she was a skeptic. She really wasn't one to believe in much of anything, to be quite honest. Mm-hmm. And then after she had this experience, she was obviously a very changed woman. So I don't know if people can access the archives that far back, but again, it was 19th November 2003 in the Daily Mail.
Is the Daily Mail a national paper or England? Or
It's in England, yes. I'm still thinking of myself as being in England half the time. It's one of our big daily newspapers in England. We've got the Daily Mail, the Daily Mirror, the London Times. Uh-huh. The Manchester Guardian and so on. But, you know, this newspaper can be accessed all over the UK.
Great.
And,
and that's, you know, that is the very similar to the story of the Pam Reynolds. And if anybody's listening who is affiliated with a medical school, if they contact IANDS.org, that's IANDS.org, they can get a copy of that for their medical school to show.
Actually, I was just talking about that when we cut off. I went straight to the portion that was describing the day I died, and they're asking $90 for that that video.
But then once they have it, it comes with a syllabus that for studying it,
okay.
And it can be used year after year with classes.
Oh, that's tremendous.
Yeah. So I would highly recommend that. It does, you need to have somebody who's wanting to take it forward in the medical school. But I understand that sometimes when you get it or something like that, you don't know if you're going to be able to take it forward, but you can have the hope.
Now,
and I encourage anybody who thinks about it to go ahead and give them a call and get it. It is a very excellent DVD made by doctors. For doctors, and of course for lay people as well, but doctors really get it.
That's excellent. Now, you're going to be speaking at our upcoming IANS conference, correct?
I am.
Okay. Do you want to give any information about that?
This is at our annual conference that we're having in Houston, Texas, in the end of October. Again, can be found on the IANS.org website. It's been our 30-year anniversary of IANS being an organization, and I've been asked to speak, to do a keynote presentation on how views have changed over these past 30 years toward near-death experiences, and how the public's awareness of near-death experiences is influencing other kinds of altered states, how it's influencing how we accept other kinds of unusual experiences.
Exactly.
So that's the gist of what I'll be talking about, and as you know, October's a ways off, so I'll be thinking about that a lot between now and then.
I bet. And again, the date for that is the 25th through the 28th of October at the University of Texas MD Anderson Center, or Cancer Center, sorry, in Houston, Texas. And it says the 2006 IANS Conference is unprecedented in the history of the organization. For the first time ever, the conference is being co-sponsored by and held at a prestigious medical venue, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. Arguably the world's largest medical complex.
It is huge.
Wow.
And personally, it's rewarding to me because Baylor Medical School is in that complex, and that's where I went to medical school.
Oh, wow.
Where I had my training. So it's really fun to be going back home and talking about near-death experiences at that first conference at MD Anderson.
Wow. Like coming full circle.
It sure is, and that is really fun for me.
That is so exciting. I guess we haven't really got the agenda yet, and I know even from my experience at the Chicago conference in 2004, a lot of things didn't come together as far as scheduling everyone until just about the very last minute.
But I will say a couple things, if I may.
Sure, please.
I know that the first 2 days, the 25th and 26th, are going to be a real emphasis on the science behind near-death experiences and some of the research that's been done. Dr. Pim van Lommel is going to be coming over from the Netherlands.
Oh, wonderful.
And he's the person who did, I would consider, the seminal research on near-death experiences. It was a 10-year study in 10 Dutch hospitals with 344 consecutive people who were revived after a cardiac standstill. Of those people, 19% of them had a near-death experience. It is such solid research that it was published in the Lancet Journal, which is like the United States New England Journal of Medicine.
Yes.
It is something that you can hang your hat on. And people who work in the healthcare professions can know for certain that 19% of the people that have a cardiac arrest have a near-death experience, whether they're telling them about it or not.
That's a good percentage right there.
That's a good percentage. It's one out of five.
Yeah.
And if healthcare professionals aren't hearing it from one out of five of their successful resuscitations, it means that they're not perceived as being open enough to tell. So they need to think for themselves, what is there about the way I'm approaching these people that keeps them from being able to tell me what really happened?
I've actually got Pim van Lommel's article on my website, Medical Evidence for NDEs.
Mm-hmm. Good.
He's tremendous, and I do plan to have him on my show, too, as soon as we can arrange for that. I am getting in touch with a lot of people, and I'm also contacting Dr. Peter Finnick, who already said that he would be very pleased to be on my show, and now we've just got to arrange that too.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm really excited about this because, you know, in such a big way, the medical community does need to be reached, because when I had my big NDE in the mid-70s and I had a number of doctors on my team, and of course the most beloved doctor to me on my case was a female, and she didn't question me for one moment. But when I did mention the fact that I'd been on this tremendous journey, referring to my NDE, to one of the male physicians, he said, "I think you need psychiatric evaluation." Well, you can imagine how that shut me down, and indeed it shut me down until just a few years ago. And that was 30 years ago this happened. And it is just, oh, I can't describe the feelings that so many of us have when somebody says that to us. I mean, it's just a slap in the face, and it makes us shut down, and it's humiliating on top of that. So we need people like you, Pam, who can get the word out and help validate the NDE, especially because you yourself are an experiencer. So you're not just hypothesizing about this. You've been there, you know what it is. You know that it's not a hallucination or something induced by drugs or what have you.
Well, I'd like to tell you a little kind of informal study I did to really answer that question about hallucinations, because
please,
it's one that always comes up.
Yes, please.
In my hospice work in Houston, I, of course, had people who were having the deathbed visions and the visitations with the deceased relatives and friends. And at first I thought maybe it was the morphine I was giving them, because most people were on morphine for their pain. And so I decided to do a little study to find out. When a person has a hallucination, there is no way to get their attention to be able to have a regular conversation with them in the middle of a hallucination.
Yes.
But when a person was visiting with a deceased relative and I walked into the room and saw them talking with someone I wasn't seeing, I could interrupt their conversation, ask them what they had for breakfast, ask them what their pain level was on a scale of 0 to 10, get coherent answers from them, and then have them turn back to really have the conversation they wanted to have, but they were too polite to tell me. And that is very different than a hallucination where I could not get a person's attention. So I feel comfortable in my own mind that I've done the right study to look at it and say, this is definitely not a hallucination.
That is tremendous. And it's so simple, too, isn't it?
It is. Yes, it didn't require a grant or any kind of big proposal. It's just plain, ordinary common sense.
And I think PMH Atwater also mentioned something about this as, you know, one of the several things that she discusses in her chapter, Debunking the Debunkers, when she's talking about why and how the NDE is real and is not a hallucination and all of these differences. Why and how it is not a hallucination. So I really, once again, appreciate that you're sharing this. Is there something else that you would like to tell us? We've got just a few more minutes here, but I'm really excited about what you're sharing, because all the validation we can get, especially from a medical person, the better.
I think the one thing that really comes to my mind that I always like to say is that the whole opening up about near-death experiences has not come through the scientific ranks, has not come through the medical profession, but has come through us ordinary folks out there who had near-death experiences and who began to talk about them to their friends. And because we've talked about them, it's allowed our friends to talk about their near-death experiences, their after-death communications. And so we're beginning to see a much larger view of reality. By convention, we all just didn't talk about 90% of what was going on. We talked only about the 10% that was conventionally safe. And now, as more and more people are talking about all of their experiences, we're beginning to get an enlarged view of the world. Physicians are not people who, in general, are reading the magazine articles that everybody else is. They don't, and so they're actually behind the lay public on this. And it's people's insistence on telling their reality to their doctors and their other healthcare professionals, which is really moving it forward in the medical profession. Really, it's really important to have the research like Dr. Van Lommel has, but it's equally important for people to get their courage up to tell the truth to their doctors.
And that's a big one, and in some ways it's a tall order just because of, you know.
I know. I know.
But you're so right, and there's no way I'm going to argue with you. But we've definitely got some work to do so that people can feel more comfortable about coming forward and sharing their experiences. And actually, I'd like to put out a plea to any physician who happens to be listening to us. To contact us, especially, you know, if you've had a near-death experience or are interested in the topic, we'd love to hear from you, too. And my website, by the by, I've not even mentioned it but during this broadcast, it is towardthelight.org. Again, towardthelight.org. And you can reach me at towardthelight@earthlink.net. Also, if you'd like to send me an email, because I am compiling information and also inviting people who would like to speak with us and help spread the word about the near-death experience. And do you have any websites, Pam?
I do. I have a website that's pamkircher.com, and that's Kircher is spelled K-I-R-C-H-E-R. And in that website, I have some things about near-death experiences, and I just actually just give myself permission to talk about everything I'm doing.
That's wonderful. Well, I'm going to look forward to seeing your website as well. Again, that is Pam, P-A-M, Kircher, K-I-R-C-H-E-R.com. Is that what you said, .com?
Yes.
Okay. Well, it has just been such a joy and such a pleasure to have you with us. Any more comment you would like to make in closing, Pam?
The only comment I'd like to make is I'm so glad that you have your show as a forum for people to explore these ideas. So just keep up the good work, Julia.
Well, thank you, my dear. And it's such an honor to have you with us. And we'll have you back again. And I'm really grateful for your patience, too, whilst our wonderful BBS radio moved to California, and we had to postpone my starting the show until March. And we've got a wonderful guest list coming up for June, too, so I hope everyone will keep joining us every Monday at 10 o'clock Central Time in the U.S., or in Greenwich Mean Time, that is minus 6 hours. And thank you, everyone, for joining us this evening for Toward the Light. And do remember that only love prevails. Blessings and
you have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a Service to Others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.